So this panel was presented as building a united progressive movement. And it was also mentioned, I think, in the call out that that's a pretty tall order. So I think that we have very very realistic expectations about what we can actually do this evening. But, you know, to start a conversation, and I mean, this conversation happens in other places, obviously at other times, but maybe not as much as it needs to. So the idea of, you know, a united progressive movement, here's a few basic ideas. You know, why have a talk like this right now? I think we've all encountered, over the last year in particular, an acceleration of a process that's really been happening, you know, from all the sort of data for about 30 years in Canada in particular. We've seen a steady erosion of things that, you know, our parents, previous generations and whatnot fought very, very hard for. We've seen an erosion of a democracy. We've seen an erosion of a sense of public good and public guardianship, whether it be healthcare, education, whether it be Social Security, all of these different institutions we've seen a steady attack on. And this attack affects all of us, you know? So what's happened over the years is obviously different movements have been focused on their own issues, which is incredibly important. I mean, there was a reason why an environmental movement had to happen, why a women's movement had to happen, why a queer movement had to happen. Very good reasons historically why individual communities needed to organize around their own issues. Understood. Very important. However, I think what we're seeing increasingly is a climate where this sustained assault is affecting all of these communities, and yet we're having a hard time being as effective in coordinated action and in really moving beyond that that atomization that occurred, that seeking of autonomy between different movements, and then learning to come together again in a way that is powerful. As I sort of say in the, I think I might have put this in the call out, learning to organize around the 80% that unites us, whether we're someone fighting for workers' rights, or student rights, or women's rights, or queer rights, or First Nations rights, or the rights of the immigrant community, the rights of the Muslim population in Canada that's being targeted with security certificates and no-fly lists. I mean, all of these issues really come back to a core set of conflicts in our society between oligarchic control and between a real social democracy or democratic socialism, whatever you want to call it, a real society with a real public good. And so what I'm hoping tonight that the different panelists can talk to, obviously a very big issue, and that we can all talk to, is first of all, you know, maybe some people think we don't need a united progressive movement, that's fine. But maybe we can talk about this whole idea of, you know, what is this thing? Do we need it? What are the challenges in creating a united progressive movement? What could it look like? How can we move beyond some of the models that are out there? These sort of really convenient coalitions that maybe last for one or two issues. You know, how do we move beyond these sorts of issues, these sorts of ways of organizing, to real relationships, you know, to really understanding commonality, to really listening to the different movement organizations and building a real commonality, not a false commonality, not a hierarchical sort of, hey, you all come under our umbrella and our banner, we'll hook you up. But how do we learn to sort of march together, organize together in a way that makes us all stronger, but that each very important organization and perspective is also appreciated for their own unique vision, unique contribution. It's a tall order. I mean, it's something that's happening globally in terms of the World Social Forum. Okay, there's organizing happening around these issues all over the world. It's sometimes been described as one no and many yeses. So I give sort of the global justice movement. You know, that a lot of people seem to know what we don't want, the neoliberal system that's falling apart all around us, the people that are being put out of work, the environment that's being destroyed, Canada becoming the global laughingstock in terms of climate change. Heavy issues. Heavy issues. How do we learn to organize around them? That's the topic tonight. And so what I want to do is I'm going to pass off the mic to seven different panelists. We have some amazing panelists here. We have Inez Rios from the St. Joseph's Immigrant Women's Center. Incredible activist, started up an incredible organization, tireless, an activist in Chile originally. A lot of incredible experience. Maria Follansbee, who has been doing a lot of amazing work around the community, around student issues, environmental issues, you name it, direct democracy, all sorts of incredible stuff. Member of the Students for a Renegade Society at McMaster. Dr. Sandra Preston from the School of Social Work at McMaster, doing a lot of great organizing in a number of different communities, the women's community, and other groups. Lindy Lukasik, the woman who sued the pants off the city, took the proceeds and created, along with Don McLean and I think it was Brian McCaddy too, Environment Hamilton. So an incredible local organization doing really, really good work. We also have Rolf Gerstenberger here, president of Steelworkers Local 1005, fresh from a May Day march, and grappling head on with some of the most intense issues right now as we see the manufacturing sector being completely gutted in Canada and locally. And the final panelist is Deirdre Dixon, who was a co-founder of the Well LGBTQ Wellness Center, former executive director of that organization, and a woman who's involved in a lot of amazing activism as well.
You were involved in the founding of it, no?
And of course, I'm Kevin. I think most people know who I am. So welcome everyone. And again, the speakers were asking we wanted 5 minutes, 5 minute takes. What's your perspective on this issue? A United Progressive Movement. What could it look like? What are the challenges? What are the opportunities? And then we want to open it up. We want it to be Q&A and dialogue about this. Maggie Hughes, we're really happy that she's here. Maggie, of course, a citizen journalist who's done a lot of amazing work covering activist issues and events. So this is all going to be recorded. It will not just end here. It will be transcribed. It will be disseminated. And hopefully it will be the start of more conversations about how do we come together as activists and as progressives in Hamilton. So at this point, I would like to call up Inez Rios. Thank you, Inez. I think she needs a round of applause.
Is it better to have it on the stand? I have a few notes that I put together, but to start, before I even go through my notes, I'd like to say that, Kevin, when you spoke about Canada, the way you perceive it now, eroding all the rights and many of them, and beginning to feel that is the moment, perhaps, to build a united progressive movement. I can tell you that it hit me because my background in political activism back home in Chile, 30 plus years ago, it was a moment when we did not have anything to lose, and we united. And the political party that needed to put together that political coalition, decided to work out the differences and put together the United Popular Movement at that time, and elect the president, and the rest is history, you know, all of it. But it was such an exciting time that I will never be able to replace that feeling with anything that happens over here. But when you said that, or we feel, began to feel as Canadians, that the system is eroding and the rights that we had are no longer, and the democracy is also eroding, I said, well, don't wait until we have nothing to lose, and then we will unite, because that will be perhaps a moment of too late, or perhaps too late to recover, right? So I'll go into a little bit of my notes. And first, I want to tell you that in this conversation, I feel that I am a member and also a beneficiary of many different movements. Because I am a woman, I am an immigrant, I am a feminist, I am a parent, I am an activist, I am also an administrator of an organization, a women's organization. I have a personal a professional interest in the different movements represented in this panel. Memberships in all these movements are very diverse, and none of us can truly represent an entire community or entire movement. And therefore, I am not here to represent an immigrant women movement or even an immigrant movement. Because if we think about it, not all immigrants are progressive, not all immigrants are poor, not all immigrants face the same barriers, and not all immigrants identify as being part or wanting to be part of any collective movement. Some may come from sad or very extreme political involvement or being victims, therefore they rather seek protection and remain in their primary, in trying to preserve their primary needs and their children. But to make a sense of an abstract diverse movement, you know, I have to think about, I can put myself as and think about individuals. And to take it even a step further, I to think about the people and the women that I work with. As an immigrant women center, we are part of many different movements. You know, we are in the women's movement, we are in the anti-poverty movement because we are trying to escape poverty. We are in many ways in the labor movement because we fight for fair, safe, sustainable employment. And of course, as a movement towards inclusion and participation of immigrants. So organizations have multiple identities and dealing with poverty, and dealing with factory emissions, if we live in a low-income neighborhood, in dealing with unfair labor practices, if we are in survival jobs. So there are a multitude of other issues that intersect in everyday life. Maybe we feel more aligned with environmental activities. For example, if a group of new immigrants from Vietnam, they are concerned about the food consumption and their food safety, would be more identified with a community garden than with other political or other social movements. In trying to unite ourselves, you know, we can resolve some of this in trying to understand all these multiple barriers and constraints. We can also try to look for common interest, and at the same time see how much of us can give away in order to reach some of commonalities aside from, in this case, the immigrant status. In a practical level, we can increase collaboration, but all of it and in all the diverse groups, sometimes you find it very unrealistic because to unite, it will require to spend energy, resources, time, and to work out those differences. Because it's easier and faster to work in isolation. So, you know, the different interest group is easier and faster to work in isolation. So we perhaps have to work towards being less rigid. And with that, my reflection is, for example, as a feminist, my concept of being a feminist might be different than of the other local organizations. But so how much it will take and what it will take to negotiate those differences and reach some kind of agreement. There is no question that we have to make sacrifices, like been, you know, spending the time. All of us are here tonight, and it's Friday night. So that requires that many more. We need many more, right, to be in this united movement. And but I'm happy to be here because this is a good start. I can also feel that as a member of the poverty roundtable in the city, I have not been able to do much. Those movements are no question. You know, they are. They call themselves. They we call ourselves to be moving towards the alleviation of poverty. But because we work so closely and tied up with the system, right, with the Canadian system, we get lost in that. There are so many personal interests that you know, to offend anybody that is, you know, in, at that table is just suicidal. So it's been extremely frustrating to me to think of how we could create a real movement. And it's been in my mind for quite some time. And I think it was after the reaction of to the budget that we are not united in a movement to react and protect. In this case, it was, you know, the last budget, the last federal budget was ignore so much of the needs and the rights of women, and it was so frustrating and broken. I was definitely very frustrated. Therefore, I thought that I, you know, to unite in a women's movement, to a coalition of women, not only immigrants in the city, even locally, to me was just very, very practical. Let's do something local so we can react to our local issues and just do at least something. Thank you very much. This, I took a little longer.
So, sorry, it's Maria, yeah.
Hi. My name's Maria. I'm an upper middle class white woman. I've had access to what this culture calls quality education my whole life. I have a good command of the English language. My mental and physical abilities allow me to move through the world with ease and safety. My sexuality is recognized and accepted as normal by this culture. My ancestors created a genocidal colonial relationship that's still here today. And my species sits on top of a steep pyramid of domination. I come to this movement with a tremendous amount of privilege. And I think that with that privilege comes a profound responsibility. I became an activist when I was first able to name and recognize the oppression in my own life, and it was a really mobilizing and empowering moment. To realize that those oppressive experiences were not just or legitimate, and that I deserved and was responsible for changing that reality. And now my privilege and power gives me the responsibility to transform oppressive social relationships that afford me access and safety that others don't have. And I think that if our movement, or movement of movements, is successful, we'll see all of those privileges dissolved. That's why for me, whatever this is that we're seeking to create, and I like to think of it as like a world of many worlds, a one no many yeses, a movement of many movements, rather than maybe like one united movement that has some name or some flag about it. I think that if what we're seeking to do is going to be really successful, we really need to embrace genuine anti-oppressive values. And that is going to take a tremendous amount of personal and collective healing. Because we've all been so thoroughly wounded by this culture that we can barely help but reproduce oppressive dynamics in our lives. And paying lip service to anti-oppression isn't enough, because we've been taught to devalue our feelings, we've been taught to devalue our experiences and not talk on those levels with each other, and so we avoid these painful, awkward, heavy, horrible conversations that that we need to have, because we need to ask each other, what is it like to be you? What is it like to walk through the world with your complex set of identities and histories and experiences? To me, that's coming from a place of compassionate curiosity. We need to seek out these answers from each other in order to move forward. We need to ask each other, how can I work to make these spaces safer for you to be who you are and for us to envision an ideal future together? That's going to be really hard. And it's going to take a lot of work. And I think that it's kind of a lifelong commitment. And what Inez was saying, it's also about patience and flexibility and not being rigid. I think that a core characteristic of this culture, and when I say this culture, I'm talking about patriarchal, dominating, capitalist, hierarchical civilization, I think. Not necessarily, well, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. I think a core characteristic of this culture is a hatred of diversity and a fear of the unnameable. And I think that we've all been sort of indoctrinated into those feelings, whether we like it or not. And so we need to purge ourselves of that hatred and of this quickness to categorize. And so constantly looking deeply and carefully and critically about how we are possibly reproducing the same power dynamics of a dominant culture in the work that we do. How do we label ourselves, and who do we seek to hear from, and what do we consider valuable? We need to ask those questions more often, I think. And reject assumptions and seek diverse voices. And this is a big one and kind of scary, I think, for a lot of activists, but also accept and, if possible, support the diversity of tactics. I think that we're not doing enough, and we're not doing enough diverse things to challenge this giant, like, multi-headed monster of a culture that we're challenging. And diversity of tactics is probably the only way we can do that. But sometimes that's scary, because sometimes those tactics might jar with our own sense of morality or our experience. So we have to look at that carefully and think about it more and embrace diversity of tactics. Because diversity is the greatest strength of this potential movement of movements. And this culture has systematically destroyed ethnic, cultural, and biodiversity for thousands of years. Diversity is the greatest threat to the status quo that we have. And I think that there are some major missing pieces from this movement. And for me, the biggest one is failure to recognize our fundamental disconnect from the natural world. I think that our biggest allies are wild nature. Soil, forests, water, and seeds are the four most powerful energy storehouses on the planet. They're literally the places where the most energy and the most power exists. And if we can figure out ways to ally with wild nature, we're golden. We're so good to go, because those places, their voices are probably some of the most marginalized, but also they hold the most potential for making a beautiful world. But that's going to be really complicated. Figuring out how to ally with wild nature is like a lifetime's worth of work for us, I think. If not generations and generations. But that's a part of this healing process that we need to go into and commit to. I also think a big missing piece is children. I think that we need to talk a lot more about what the ideal future of children is, and or what their visions are, and how we can make the world safer for them. They're the people who are going to be inheriting this mess that we're making. And I became an activist when I was like 7, when Ralph Klein was elected Premier of Alberta. And my best friend's mom took me to this rally, and it was like the most amazing day of my life. And I've been mobilized ever since. And if kids can be brought up in that kind of environment, I think that they can do a lot better than we've done so far. So I think the kids are a big missing piece from this movement. And a third thing that I think we really need to look and explore is healing at a cultural level. Our stories and our celebrations and our languages and our gestures and our life ways are infused with the destructive values of colonial, capitalist, patriarchal domination. And a massive challenge that I'm really curious about is, how do we transform at a cultural level? How do we collectively create new cultural expressions that are rooted in anti-oppressive, diverse, nature-loving, human-loving, life-loving values? We need to celebrate together and get comfortable with our sensuous, irrational, imaginative selves again. And so cultural revolution and transformation are really fundamental to making sure that whatever structural solutions we create as a movement of movements stay strong, because they'll be embedded in the way that we live our everyday lives. And I know that's like a huge task, and I have no idea how to do it, but it's important to think about. Finally, I think that imagination has to play a big part in this. We need to be inspired enough to keep doing this every day, because otherwise we'll all just get swallowed in despair. And all too often we're totally reactionary and just using the word anti a lot. And I know I keep saying anti-oppression, so I'm hypocrite, but whatever. Offering people visions, imaginative, glorious visions of the future is, I think, going to be really critical in this moment, especially as more and more people lose faith in this culture every day. And I don't really have a very good thing to say at the very end.
You did a lot of good saying.
So, there it is.
Follow that. I'm sure I had that much passion when I still have lots of passion, but just not. Yeah, no, I can't manage that. I teach here at the university, and I'm a professor. But my response is incredibly practical and down to earth, which is kind of who I am, anyways. Even if I'm a professor, I think that our only choice to live good lives is to engage in this process, to engage in a process of change and imagination and connection with nature, connection with children, which is where my heart often lands, and a focus on the positive rather than the negative. I've spent most of my life being an activist, and my dad called me a commie pinko when I was 11, so I started young as well. And it's defined who I am and how I live and how I've raised my children and how I teach. And I really think it's the only way to live and be honest with yourself, and be a part of life rather than disconnected from it. Because I agree with Maria that the structure that we have and the culture that we have works very hard to keep us disconnected from each other and disconnected from the world, because that's how power is maintained. I would also say that I don't think power brings any great, wonderful stuff with it. It might keep you safer. It might mean that you don't have to worry about things that other people have to worry about, but I'm not sure that it makes you a happy person or a fulfilled person or even a whole person. So I think that one of the things that we don't talk about enough is how those who have privilege also would benefit from change. Would benefit from a different world and a different way of living. And I don't know how much joy an SUV can really bring to your life. That may be because I don't have an SUV, but maybe I just don't get it. But I also think that imagination, as Maria said, is central to change and building a diverse but even loosely united movement. And I agree that, you know, trying to put it all under one umbrella is not going to work. But connection and relationship is. Getting to know people, getting to know who they are and how they live, I think is central to the work that we do. And again, back to imagination. I worked in a lot of alternative in quotation marks, I don't know what other word to use, organizations. And I think some of them crumbled. And some of them crumbled because of a lack of faith and patience and imagination. And understanding that we're doing something totally new, that other people haven't really, that they've done before but done it different ways. But if we're going to try something totally new, as Maria says, it's going to feel weird and different and difficult. And that's okay. That of course it's going to be weird and different and difficult. And the number of consensus-based meetings that I sat in for 8 to 12 hours while people got more and more frustrated. People revert to hierarchy because that's what they know. And it's easy and everybody knows the rules. And so when people get frustrated, they revert to what they know. But to do something very different, to work on it with a consensus model, for example, means that you have to give yourself time and be kind and gentle with each other. And we're not good at that. We're not good at being kind and gentle with each other. And I think that's one of the things, and I come mostly from working in the women's movement, is that we're raised as women to think about being kind and gentle. I'm not sure how many of us are very good at it. Some of us not very good at all. But that idea and also the focus on relationships, I think, can bring a lot to a united movement. And really, all you have are the other people in your life when it comes right down to it. And so those relationships, and not your SUV, are what, I don't know why I'm picking on SUVs, but are what sustain you and what make you you. And that's what I would recommend, that the centrality of relationships is what will build a diverse and united movement in whatever way you think of united. And that those difficult conversations, and I wanna emphasize again that I think those difficult conversations, yes, they're difficult, but they're also wonderful. How many of you have had like amazing conversations about really difficult issues with really frustrating people? And that those are the conversations that I think change your thinking and change who you are. Even if you're yelling at the person across from you, you walk away and you think about what they've said to you. And so those conversations, I think we need to remember the joy in all those difficult things. And I'm glad you said something about saying auntie, and we do use that a lot, like the whole anti-oppression. And I teach about oppression and anti-oppression. That's a treat. You can see the resistance in people to having the way that they see the world, the way they view the world, having that challenged, and how difficult it is for people. So I think compassion, which is something else that Maria said, compassion is really important. And Inez talked about how connected we all are, but how difficult it is for us to make those connections and to not be sucked in by the power relationships that we're taught and that are established outside of us and that impact our lives every day. I mean, there are dangers to working, to being an activist, and I think sustaining your joy and your faith and your happiness in the light of those is part of our individual challenge and also challenge as a group.
Thank you, Sandy. So, Linda, are you ready? The next contestant?
To realize that profound societal change is what's going to resolve the environmental crisis and a lot of other crises that are ailing us as a society. So I'm certainly a fan of the idea of a progressive movement, because the world's not going to change unless we have that kind of a collaborative effort for change. But I'd extend the call even further. I think we're talking here tonight, we need to talk about bringing progressive social movements together, but when we do that, we talk about the kind of strategy that we embrace to make that happen. We can't forget about the big wide world that's out there. So I think we need to avoid the mistake of bringing ourselves together but forgetting about how we go out there into that world and face-to-face with a lot of the people out there who maybe don't agree with the broader vision for change that we'll all come together, I hope, and build as we move forward. And that's something I struggle with a lot. How do you get out there and make that change happen in the world? How do you convince all the people out there that there are crises that we're struggling with that we can turn into something amazing if we make the right kinds of commitments and changes? It's not an easy thing. So I just wanted to talk about some of the challenges that I see that we're going to face at, you know, going down that road of trying to build a collective progressive movement. One is what I call the danger of dogma, and a lot of others who've spoken already have talked about this, that whole notion of embracing diversity means embracing diversity. We can't expect to come together as a movement, but hold on to some of our deep-seated ideologies. We've got to open the door to other perspectives and other views of the world and figure out how we fit the right pieces together to get ourselves to where we need to go. And I think there's also the challenge of change itself, and we always struggle with this within the environmental community. How do we get out there and change the world? We have a lot of debates on different issues about, do you go out there and tell people that the sky is falling, or, you know, do you go out there and encourage people to take small baby steps and that's going to make a difference? How do you go out there and what kind of strategy do you embrace and implement out there? And I think that takes us right back to diversity, that you need a whole spectrum of approaches, and I think that's one thing that we've learned. There are times for a more radical sort of push for change and other times when baby steps are what maybe make most sense. Or maybe it's a matter of just building a whole menu, a diverse menu of opportunities to get different people engaged, people who are out there in the world at different stages of their thinking on issues. And I know I've found that even within the activist networks that I work with, depending on how long you've been involved, I think what happens when you've been an activist for a long time, you can sort of look back and see in others, to some degree, a reflection of where maybe you were at when you first started to get involved in an issue. And so some of it is understanding that and supporting that and to some degree allowing people to go through what they need to go through to move on to the next phase in their efforts. And then there's the whole issue of integrating issues. How are we going to bring the pieces together? We all bring wonderful perspectives on a whole range of issues to the table, and how do we weave it all together into a progressive movement? And I think that's going to be a challenge. But at the same time, I'm really hopeful on that front. I think we're all here tonight because we all sense in our guts that something's happening out there in the world. And part of it is we're surrounded by crisis, economic crisis, you know, climate change crisis, the threat of peak oil and the profound kind of impact it's going to have on society as we know it. All of these things coming down on at us, but at the same time, I don't know about the rest of you, but I have this sense in my gut that there's something else happening, and it's not... There's the crisis, but there's this window opening for profound transformative change to happen, and I think if we come together and grab onto that opportunity, amazing things can happen. Amazing things. And I feel that in my gut. And I guess I operate on instinct to some degree, and I'm sure a lot of the rest of you do as well in the work that you do. So I think now is the time. Ines said, don't lose the opportunity, don't wait till we have no other option. Start moving now, and then we'll get to someplace incredible. So what are some of the opportunities involved? I think I've already said embrace the crisis as an opportunity. Use that glass as half full rather than glass as half empty kind of approach. We're sitting in the thick of all of these crises. And the way I'm looking at it now is, heck, well, what choice do we have though to embrace transformative change? So how do we do it? How do we be creative and innovative? Let's celebrate the amazing opportunities that the crisis presents, that the multiple crises present. This is the fuel. These crises are the fuel that are really going to drive the rest of society to think about change. And it's clear, it's cooperation and building strong communities that's going to help us to set that new course. And I shudder to think, for instance, about where we might be heading if we try to patch together the same old kinds of approaches, especially when it comes to things like economic development. I'm really you know, listening to the news and scratching my head a lot about whether the solutions and the dollars that are being thrown at solutions are really the right thing from any perspective, economic, social, cultural, environmental. And I just wanted to, just to get you thinking, I read this the other day in some searching that I was doing for another little project I was working on. And it really struck me. It's a treaty on alternative economic models, and it was developed by the International Non-Governmental Organization Forum in Rio de Janeiro back in 1992. I keep going back and reading it because I think they really sort of captured the kind of thing we need to be thinking about, especially within the context of an economic crisis, where we might move forward as a progressive movement. And what they said is the fundamental purpose of economic organization is to provide for the basic needs of a community in terms of food, shelter, education, health, the enjoyment of culture, as opposed to a concentration on the generation of profit and on the growth of production for its own sake. So economic life must also be organized in such a way that it enhances rather than destroys the environment and safeguards natural resources for the use of future generations. So I keep reflecting on this alternative economic model, and I can't help but try to envision the kind of community that could achieve all of these things. And no doubt there are huge barriers to get us there. I mean, just think about tackling the issue of profit generation or growth production for its own sake. I mean, if we all walked out the door tonight and started yelling and screaming about those issues, I think we'd be hard-pressed to find. I hope that the audience will grow, but I still think it would be a challenge for us to go out there and do that sort of thing. But I think there are signs of hope, and I think we need to grab onto those. And again, that's that whole idea of optimism. And I really appreciate the comments about the anti. We're always focused on anti, because I've been guilty of it. I mean, I think in the environmental community, we've been hugely guilty of focusing on the negative. But you're seeing these amazing movements emerge now that are pulling together threads. And one of them that I've seen, you know, in Dundas, anyone from Dundas will know about Transition Town and the Transition Town movement. And I think those kinds of movements are movements we should look to because they're pulling the pieces together and they're thinking about visions for how we can move forward in a more progressive way. The relocalization movement and that principle, which is so important in Transition Town. So I guess I want to end by saying let's work for transformative change together as though our lives depended on it, because I think our lives do. I mean, I think if we don't take this opportunity now to turn crisis into opportunity, we're in big trouble. So, see, there I go again. I think it's hopeful. Grab onto it. Let's go for it. So, thanks.
Thank you very much, Lynette. I'm glad you mentioned Transition Town, because actually, Graham McQueen couldn't be here this evening because there's a Dundas Transition Town Steering Committee meeting, which is on, and he sort of double booked himself. So, yeah, that's why he's here this evening. Great movement. Rolf Gerstenberger, come on up and be great. Thanks. I think Rolf definitely needs a round of applause.
So I appreciate the initiative that Kevin has taken to deal with this question, which is, it's a question that for myself goes back to the late 60s. I come out of the youth and student movement in the States, and then came to Canada as a draft dodger. And one of our slogans, the main slogan, what we were looking for back then when I was young, was how do the people get power? That all these decisions at that time are being made, whether it's the Vietnam War or whatever, and that was the one that was one of the important ones at that time, were being made without any input from the people. When there was massive resistance to it, they still basically decided to just proceed, shot students, tried to suppress us, tried to shut us up. The whole free speech movement came out of that we had the right to at least object, we had the right to want a better world. So that, for me, that's 40 years ago, and now I'm the president of the local Town 5, the local that's at the old Stelco plant, which a year and a half ago got bought up by U.S. Steel, so now we're part of the U.S. Empire, and then a month and a half ago they announced they're closing us down until the economy picks up. So that, for us, it's been, I've been the president for 6 years now. I just got elected to another term. It's been a hell of a ride. Because we first started with the bankruptcy, 2.5 years of fighting the bankruptcy that the old Stelco applied. We are the first union in history in Canada that didn't give up anything during a bankruptcy fraud. And that was a huge battle because the whole society, the whole establishment, all the other unions, everybody was telling us that in bankruptcy, everybody's got to lose something, so you might as well get in there and play ball. And we refused. We said we as workers have rights. We have our contract. We expect everyone to live up to the contract. We're doing our part. We're making steel. And that's what we signed up to do. And the company agreed to pay us our wages and benefits, and we're going to hold them to it. So it was a huge battle. But the key to it was that first we took a slogan from the women's movement that we said no means no. We are saying no, and too bad you have to find some other way of accomplishing what you want. Right after we got out of bankruptcy, the next big thing we had was the Douglas Creek issue, where the Six Nations reoccupied their land at Douglas Creek. We took a stand on that right away. Now, even though we had several hundred of our members live out there, and it was a huge battle there was a lot of pressure on us. Why are we supporting the Native people? What business do unions have supporting the Native people anywhere? And there was huge votes between the media and some of our members, and then the silence of the labor movement on that issue. Again, we said that this is a just cause, and we weren't going to capitulate to any kind of pressure that the media especially was putting against us. This is a just stand. And anyway, it's one thing after the other to take these stands. Now, I appreciate what you're trying to do here. It's very positive, in my opinion, because you're trying to grapple with this thing of how the people get the political power so they have some control over their lives and can decide how things should happen. Our success, and the only reason I've been able to survive, is the only reason that we were able to survive. Want me to wait?
Doesn't make any sense to me. You have no audio. I'll get you another mic.
I should. Yeah, okay. Great. Is it just I was away? No. Okay. Anyway, we started 6 years ago, and we continued it to this day, that every Thursday afternoon, we have what we call an open forum, where basically I present a report on everything that's happened in the last week, and not just about union stuff or company stuff or whatever, but also in issues that affect the Canadian people. I give a report, we provide written documents, information, and then we open it up for the discussion. My report's roughly about half hour long, and then we have discussion. We have from anywhere, each week, from anywhere from 50 to 100 people in slow times, and then have several hundred people show up. Some of these workers have showed up there for 6 years every week to discuss politics. So when we took a stand both on this bankruptcy, on the Six Nations, on supporting the Palestinian people, we discuss it, depending on how hot the topic is, literally every week. And not everyone there agrees with what we're doing, but the forum is there to discuss so that eventually, the way discussion works is if you participate, especially if you have the nerve and you're brave enough to get up and speak, that means you have to think about it. And the people who are listening have to think about it. And it's not just out there and then, okay, yeah, I agree with that. We refuse to do that. We force people to discuss that what should, in the sense of what should we do. So it's that for us, as I said, it's 6 years of that, and that's the strength that we have. Like today we had over 700 workers participated in this May 1st rally demonstration. A year ago we had about 350. A month ago, when 2 weeks after Stelco announced they're closing us down, we had a forum and then a demonstration of over 2,000 of our workers to object to this. So we're building through these discussions a conviction. It's important to have these discussions so you have conviction on what we're doing, what stand you're taking, why you're saying no in particular, and what the future is. So one of the big issues we're dealing with now, and this came out of our bankruptcy, is this question of how do the working people in particular get political power? Like, how can these factories be shut down? Huge factories, you know, where Canada needs steel, and someone in Pittsburgh decides that we're going to shut a steel plant down. No one's convinced us that Canada doesn't need steel, that they don't need roads, they don't need buildings, they don't need anything. And they're saying, we made a decision, and out of the blue, no justification. And then they tell you, oh, you'll get your job back when the economy picks up. And this is real people that are being affected by that. And what happens is first you go on unemployment. Then after 35 weeks or 40 weeks, then you run out of unemployment. Then you start asking, and this is a real life question, they ask us, well, should I put my house up for sale now? Are we ever getting that? So then they have to liquidate all their assets. And now these are steel workers who were relatively well paid for workers. And now they're talking about putting up their house for sale, trying to find some other jobs. And we have one of our friends, their daughter works in a small auto parts, it's a supply company. They had 400 resumes for a job that didn't exist, delivering parts to dealers. And so 400 resumes from steel workers looking for a job. So this is what's out there. So what do we get from the politicians? You get that, well, wait till the recovery comes. Wait till the economy recovers. Wait, you know, it's no big deal. So who makes that decision that you can wait? So we're trying to say that this is an emergency situation. This requires emergency measures, and of course nobody listens and nobody cares. And so we're up against this. So everyone, you know, like we say, for instance, one of the things every week we go down and we're leafleting down on King and James. Our banner there is layoffs aren't solutions. So our analysis is that every time you lay people off and thousands of people off, you make the crisis worse. And that no one yet has disputed that. So this layoffs, these hundreds of thousands, I think the number, anyway, last month it was 66,000 in Canada, it was 660,000 in the States. Every one of those layoffs makes the economic crisis worse, but it's allowed. And why is it allowed? Because each company has the right to decide what's best for their bottom line, even if it wrecks the economy. So we use the example of a year ago, the TTC workers in Toronto were sent back to work in 31 minutes. They had a special session of the legislature. I don't know if people follow that, but we definitely did a special session on a Sunday. They called all three parties together. They all agreed unanimously to send these workers back to work in 31 minutes. The reason they gave was that this strike, they were on strike Monday morning, it was going to wreck the economy of Toronto. It was going to be terrible for the economy of Toronto. We can't allow this. So that they passed, no problem, in 31 minutes. But now you say, well, these measures you're taking are wrecking the economy, making the crisis worse. Why is it allowed? Why aren't the similar emergency measures taken in 31 minutes to say you can't do this? So of course then, as Kevin says, you know, we're up against the monopoly might, the rulers, you know, they've got the priority, even though it's wrecking the economy. So it shouldn't be allowed. We, as workers, we have no power. We're not political enough. We don't have the power to stop it. So we have to find some way of doing it. So in that sense, I'm here to, you know, sort of listen. I'm listening quite carefully. We will
what's being raised here. We will report back. That's what we always do, and we'll discuss it as far as what is being done in the community. We're very interested in that. And then, you know, down the road, we'll see how it can work. So anyways, thank you.
Thank you. Deirdre Dixon.
Around a bit. I kind of like jumping because I've been sitting for like listening to really, really interesting discussions of this topic. And you all have much more interesting things, I think, to say than I do. I mean, I'm just learning a lot. So thank you, each one of you. And thanks everyone for coming. Thank you, Kevin, for organizing this. Yeah, so maybe I'll just jump a bit more. Honestly, I don't really have notes prepared because I set aside time this afternoon to do this, and then, not surprisingly, life got in the way, and the work I actually do at the well kind of required, you know, some stuff to be done, you know, and a youth dropped by and we wanted to talk, and then there were some posters to be picked up, and suddenly it was 6 o'clock, and oh my God, I had to be here. And that, to me, actually strikes me as one of the first challenges of building any movement, and certainly trying to unite across already established, or in some cases, very well established movements. And this, we're all really busy already doing so much work. And you know, I really respect what you're saying about imagination and, you know, sort of coming together and building relationships, and I totally agree with you about building relationships, but I think we're also already doing a lot of this work, so part of my challenge is, oh my God, how do I find the time to help build a United Progressive Movement while I'm still trying to, you know, keep our little totally volunteer-run center going, or, you know, you're trying to keep, you know, the funding coming in to continue training, you know, immigrant women and introducing them to the job market, or, you know, you're probably marking papers from time to time. And I'm not trying to be negative, I think I'm just trying to be very concrete about this, because I tend to think in very concrete ways when somebody asks me a question like, how do you create a United Progressive Movement? And I think, okay, well, what are the steps? You know, step one, step two, and, you know, this was sort of step zero. I also, as I was sort of thinking about this while I was, you know, driving the car, so, you know, bear with me. I'm just going to kind of shake my head sideways and a bunch of ideas are going to fall out, and I don't know if they're really valid, but bear with me and maybe we can sort through them. I was thinking that certainly coming from my perspective, and, you know, I'm speaking very much as an activist in the queer community. I've also, you know, worked to some extent with women's organizations. And I worked as a student union activist, like here at McMaster as a union activist, as a teaching assistant. I was active in the QP local here. But primarily I'm working now within the queer community in Hamilton and trying to really build a sense of community. And the first thing I have to say I thought of when I talked about thinking about progressive is I think, goodness! Progressive in the queer community? I mean, there's some of us who are progressive, but there's lots of people in the queer community, you know, lesbian, gay, lots of gay men, who probably would not self-identify as being progressive. So that was, you know, and I don't want to make an assumption just about gay men, but just I think about my experiences, you know, as within this community, and it's by no means a sort of universal identity. And I think probably, and I think Inez, you were sort of speaking to this a little bit too, that, you know, their immigrants have wildly different experiences, and not everyone would identify even as a sort of, in the way that perhaps you would be talking about sort of an immigrant experience or a newcomer experience. Certainly, I've spoken to persons who work in the women's movement within the sort of feminist context, and boy, you know, that whole idea that we're all, you know, like all women are sort of united by their vaginas, kind of, and we're all feminists. No, not happening. if we're going to engage in this discussion of some sort of unity, and, you know, I'm not even touching unity at the moment, that we actually need to start thinking about the breakdown of identity politics, right? What we're all kind of, I think, in varying ways kind of dancing around is that identity politics, as powerful as they have been and as powerful as they, you know, in some ways continue to be, are also potentially a barrier for us. And so I'm not sure, but I don't want to dissemble identity politics in the next, you know, 2 minutes or something. But I think that's maybe a little bit of some of the flexibility that's been discussed. And I'm wondering if, like, and then I tried to think, well, okay, if I'm kind of, you know, taking issue with identity politics, then, you know, where am I seeing commonality? And so I'm wondering if our commonality starts to lie, now this is just a sort of hypothesis I'm kind of playing with it at the moment, but what I'm kind of, and what I'm kind of hearing tonight, sort of gathering, has to do more with a particular, and I apologize for the esotericness here, but a particular analysis of power, if you will, a sort of observation of particular sorts of oppression, the observation, you know, that we are sensitized to, that we are conscious of, we are aware of, and we are, you know, emotionally and intellectually moved in a bad way, like negatively moved by oppression that we observe and experience and hear about within the sort of shared mass-mediated culture that we have helped create. And so I'm wondering if, you know, moving towards sort of talking about, and I don't want to go all anti or anything like that, and I really appreciate what you're saying about anti-oppression, anti-oppressive practice, but if thinking about the ways that, you know, the collective sorts of, I think, movements that we kind of have represented here kind of understand and react to oppression is actually a place to start. So suddenly it's not, you know, let's just take some crazy glue, and I'm just grossly oversimplifying, but and glue environmentalism to the women's movement, to the labor movement, to, you know, queer rights, and, you know, throw away the crazy glue at that point, or something like that. But it means, you know, sort of actually interrogating why we were already invested in wherever we come from in terms of a sort of progressive movement. And I guess that's where our sort of flexibility and the challenge comes from, is then saying, okay, can I sort of maybe generalize that outward a little bit? And where do I start to meet intellectually with, or even emotionally with, others who seem to share sort of direction? So that's just kind of one idea that kind of fell out of my head. And I don't know, you know, feedback, please. I guess for Q&A, feedback, please. Second thought. I lost one. Anyway. The actual second thought was, I agree that we are trying to move towards a kind of unity, but I think I can't help, and here I'm going to be irritating and sort of, you know, refer to the only theorist I actually ever really liked very well, which is Michel Foucault, and I don't even like Foucault that well because I don't really like theory, but I don't really have much use for long, kind of tedious books that, you know, are hard to read. But Foucault, when he's talking, and at one point, I think it's in the History of Sexuality, Volume 1, talks about power as sort of constantly sort of, it's very dynamic and changing and constantly changing. So he talks about resistance and resistance that needs to be also localized and very sort of temporal. Like you cannot have a monolith, you cannot monolithically resist even monolithic power. And so I hear what you're saying about a diversity and a multiplicity of strategies, and I totally agree. And I think even in our sort of conception of unity, whatever unity looks like, that unity is probably going to be a very dynamic kind of unity. It's not a monolithic unity. Like, again, you can't get it. As tempting it is, it is, at least in my head, to just kind of stick movements together, I don't think that's really a fruitful direction. I think that those unities are going to be constantly negotiated and renegotiated, and we'll get better at that with practice and with time and with building relationships. But that inevitably, because resistance must be sort of multifaceted and dynamic, we must be. If anything, we must be like the flying squad, if you will, of, you know, certain union locals who are here, and then they're there, and then they're somewhere else. We almost need to consider, I wonder if we need to consider unity as almost being like a flying squad. So there is a need, and we respond to a need. And gradually, through building relationships and through just communicating, building understanding, you know, I'm still teaching very, very good, wonderful people. Like, so I'm not even talking of, you know, Tory voters or anything, you know, awful like that, but just really wonderful people. Good people, good-hearted people, you know, how you respond to a trans person, because the trans identity is so, basically, from a mainstream standpoint, so new. And it's not new. I'm not saying trans people are new, they're not, but the identity as sort of readily available, sort of understood within a sort of, again, mainstream mass-mediated context is something that really, you know, is only kind of happening now. Trans activism has only been sort of happening in the last 15 to 20 years kind of thing, and that's not here. That has been 15 to 20 years, I don't think. We're kind of slow. You know, so I think it's constant building and constant learning and constant... I need to learn a lot, because I'm speaking from many of the same places of privilege as you are. I can really relate to what you said, the way you opened your comments, because I'm speaking from a lot of those same areas of privilege. I need to learn a lot. I should probably be quiet very soon, in fact. But there's also a lot of teaching to do. So I seem to be contradicting myself, because I said I don't have time for this, and now I'm saying, look at all this time you need to do spending doing this. But I guess this is maybe inherently contradictory. I guess... in terms of just about two or three very quick last comments that occurred to me, in terms of sort of practically, you know, bringing sort of some of our identity communities along in this project, I mean, I would say when I'm sort of working on projects, it's always a case of try to show, not tell. So let's, you know, I don't think I can necessarily go back to, you know, the trans group or, you know, our women's, you know, queer women's support group and say, you know, we kind of talk theoretically about uniting. But when I can go back and say, look, there's, you know, some amazing people who want to make some amazing changes, and this has an impact on your life, and you can get involved. And here are the ways you can get involved. So it becomes very concrete, very real, and it can kind of show, not tell, well, I am relaying in words, but there's something, there's a concrete thing that's there. I think that's when people buy in more. So that's one last, and then last quick comment. I agree totally that I think we might be at a place, we might be at a point of major change, major transition. I think that's up to us. I can't help thinking of what happened in England after the French Revolution and all the promise, and you see this in the writings of both the early and later second generation Romantic poets, all that potential for liberation, all that liberatory speech, but what happened in England after the French Revolution and all that so-called chaos is there was actually a snapping back a movement of tremendous conservatism. And so I think that we need to actually move very actively. I sometimes feel that we're in one of those leg traps, and we're sort of pushing it open, pushing it open, pushing it open. But if we don't act very aggressively and smash that trap, it's just going to snap closed again. Thanks.
Awesome.